Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. On this episode, I'm very excited to have multi-billionaire investor, author, businessman, philosopher, Jim Mellon. Jim, thanks for doing this.
Oh, thanks, Jess. It's really nice to meet you. I'm very pleased to be on.
Well, I need to start with a shout out to our mutual friend, Greg Bailey, for putting us together. Why don't I start with some of what I know about your career path and life, and then have you fill in the blanks that I miss. Is that okay?
Perfect.
So grew up in the UK, which my family is very much from. I grew up in Western Canada, but my grandpa still has cousins in the UK and stuff like this, and back and forth. But grew up in the UK, father is a diplomat. When you graduated, gone to Oxford, and when you graduated, you had the explorer bug. So you went to Hong Kong to work for GT, now LGT. And over the years, they ended up sending you over to San Francisco, and you got to witness the rise of Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and founders of Compaq and those computer companies. Ended up starting your own company. And was it called Thornton? I didn't quite figure out that your investment business. Is that Thornton?
No, that was the T of GT. He was kicked out of GT, and I worked with him, but I owned 10% of Thornton. And that, when that was sold 4 years later, I had enough money to start my own company, which was called Regent.
Regent. And did you start that in 91?
No, I think, well, yeah, maybe 92. Yeah.
Okay. And emerging manager, I mean, going everywhere in the emerging markets, all the way from Russia to China, and saw massive rises there. These days, much more focused on biotech and clean food and property. Your family office, Burnbrae Group, banking, mining, hotels, substantial landholder in Germany, diverse range of projects, that you're chairman and co-founder of Juvenescence, not an executive director of Condor Gold, Portage Biotech, Brada Head Limited, Chelsea Avondale Limited, Agronomics Limited, executive chairman of Max Financial Group, owner of Consistor Bank, established the Mellon Longevity Fund, the Mellon Longevity Center at Oxford, also an honorary fellow at Oriel College. Am I saying that last one correctly?
You are. Perfect.
Run 43 marathons, but these days saving joints and more focuses on getting your 15,000 steps a day. Spend a lot of time on Isle of Man and in Ibiza. And what are some of the highlights I missed there, along with the other five books and the new book coming out?
You've actually summarized me perfectly. I don't have nothing more to say, really, to be quite honest, Jess. I've kind of, because I want to tell you a story, right? So when I was sent to San Francisco, I was 21 or 22 years old. And I mean, what an exciting place that was. Where are you based, by the way, Jess?
I'm outside of Park City, Utah.
Okay, right. You know, San Francisco's gone up and recently gone down and maybe up again, hopefully. But when I went there, it was the real early days of the tech boom. And of course, I didn't know it and I knew nothing about technology. So I went off to this conference in Palm Springs in California. I'll never forget it. And I'm on this plane, which was PSA. You're probably too young to remember what PSA was, but it was called Pacific Southwest Airlines. And they flew little British-made jets, and they were quite a big airline. Anyway, go to Palm Springs. At the conference, there's Bill Gates yabbering on. He's only a few years older than me. And then Steve Jobs as well, yabbering on. And I'm sitting there somewhat, I mean, you know, skeptical and somewhat jealous, to be quite honest, because, you know, why do they have all that money and I have none? Anyway, get on the aeroplane on the way back to San Francisco, and who are the two people sitting in front of me but Bill Gates and Steve Jobs? And it was a rarity that they were together because, as you know, there was a lot of animus between them. My life could have been changed if I'd had enough guts to go up or just right in front of me to say, hey, guys, you know, you were great at the conference. Can you tell me a bit more about what you're up to? But I didn't have the guts to do it. And today, I'm probably going to come across as a weirdo, but today I will have no hesitation in talking to anyone because you never know how your life might change if you do that. So the point I'm making is I've kind of had to, because I'm not Bill Gates or Steve Jobs or anyone like that, I've had to navigate through waters in my life, which means constant change. And actually, I think constant change is the way that everyone's going to have to navigate from now on, because there is no security. There's no, you know, career that you can do for 50 years. Everything is changing. And this is the message that needs to be conveyed to everyone who's young. You will not be in the same job in 20, 30 years' time. Don't think about it. It's not going to happen.
You know, I'd actually love to hear a little more about that experience. You know, I grew up mostly in a little farming community in Western Canada. And I moved to Southern California in my early 20s and got into investment banking on a mergers and acquisitions team at Citi. And California was amazing to me. What was it like to you? Or did you kind of know what you were in for?
No, I didn't know what I was in for. And I thought it was just fantastic. It's one of the best periods of my life. And then, so I went back to Hong Kong, where I'd started. And I was in Hong Kong for another 12 years. And a friend of mine left GT and went off and started his own company, which is called Matthews International. It's a big manager for Americans, particularly retail investors, to invest in Asia. And so, you know, after the years went by, and I thought, well, I'll go and reconnect with Paul Matthews. So I went to San Francisco, saw him and his wife, and I thought, I'll buy a flat here. So I bought an apartment in San Francisco. And just before the pandemic, I went back, and, you know, it was just a shocking place. And I'm sure you've been there with all the grime and crime and just the destitution and hopelessness and despair. And I thought, I'm going to sell. So I sold. And then I bought a place in Florida just before the pandemic. So this was a very good move on my part. It's total luck. But now, on Monday, I'm going to go to Florida to a conference and then go and visit this apartment that I bought in Florida. You know, San Francisco, it's great for technology, et cetera, but it's not a great city to live in my opinion. Now,
yeah.
Shame.
And what's the name of the longevity conference you're speaking at?
It's not the longevity conference. It's called iConnections. It's the biggest alternative asset conference in the world.
Oh, okay.
There's about 1,000 LPs who turn up there. It's highly curated. But they've asked me to speak with Alan Patrickoff, who I'm sure you know, who's just recently got married for the third time at the age of 90 in New York, which is very impressive. And so he and I are on a panel talking about longevity, him from a personal experience and me from more the scientific background sort of stuff.
Yeah, it's so exciting. Well, yeah. You know, today we want to talk about longevity, we want to talk about food, we want to talk about quantum, we want to talk about fusion and anything else you want. But let's start with longevity. You know, I bought your book, Juvenescence, and I got started and I was surprised to see you forward by our friend, Greg Bailey. And, you know, you guys have had such great successes. I think I was just going through some of the numbers that he talks about in the foreword of, you know, at Medivation, I mean, getting involved, starting at a $12 million pre-money valuation and selling it for $14.3 billion to Pfizer. And then Biohaven, you know, starting out $3.5 million raise and then $200 million and then selling that, I believe, for $11 billion to Pfizer. Is that right?
Well, Biohaven's still going on and Greg's still on the board of it. So it did sell the asset, which was the migraine drug migraine, as you call it in America, to Pfizer, but the rest of it's still going and it's worth $4 billion on the New York Stock Exchange. So it's been a remarkable success, but we mustn't forget that we have a third partner called Dec Dugan, who is a remarkable drug developer, and he has been the glue that's bound the three of us together, really. And he's an understated Scotsman.
You beat me to it, because Greg has had such nice things to say about him, but I haven't met him yet. I'm interested in how the two of you got to work with him and why he is so special to the two of you.
Well, I think this is sheer luck. Greg and I met through a mutual friend here in London. And, you know, Greg spends a lot of time in the UK. And we hit it off. We've got very similar aspirations. And we are very respectful of each other as investors with different skill sets. And we've done so much together in the last 20 years. You know, he is actually the chairman of Juvenescence. I'm the deputy chairman. And he is full in, all committed to the cause of extending human life. I'm waiting for the pills to come along in 10 years' time, and I'll be an avid taker of them. But I'm not going to go through the calorific restriction and the, you know, the sort of self-flagellation that Greg goes through on a daily basis to enable himself to be certain to live longer.
So, yeah. No, when we were at Formula One together, and like they're like, "Where's Greg?" Oh, all his friends knew. Oh, he went home because when he goes on flights, like he does not sacrifice his sleep. He's gone. You know, we're at this.
Oh no, he is.
We're at this big party. There's like Mark Wahlberg and all this stuff going on, and like Greg's gone because he needed to get sleep because he takes it seriously.
No. Well, he does take it very seriously. I think I can't remember how many pills he takes a day, but it's quite a lot. He looks great. He is in very good form at the moment, and he and I talk just about every single day. He's a remarkable individual, but you know, the three of us sort of hit it off, and every week we have a catch-up call wherever we are, and talk about the various issues that we have. And it's not all good. I mean, this, you know, we've got some challenges as well, but generally speaking, we're having a blast about this. So you know, Greg has his forte is doing those sort of Mark Wahlberg type events where, you know, influencers and people like, well, yourself, who's got a very big voice, are around. I am kind of, my audience, if you want to put it that way, is in the Middle East and in Asia, where I was for so long, and here in the UK. So we have a different audience, but nonetheless, audiences are very interested. Who doesn't want to live for another 10 years in healthy condition? I mean, let's face it, you know, this could be a huge market, and I think it will be a huge market. And we've hired a really, really good guy to run the company, called Richard Marshall, who came from AstraZeneca. And we've got 20 shots on goal. I'm pretty confident with the record of the team that we'll get at least one of them on goal. And as you can see, 3.5 million to 12 billion plus 4 billion in the remaining equity on the New York Stock Exchange. There's a good record to look at. What I will say is that the idea that Greg and I put in $1 million each into Biohaven and we end up with a third each of Biohaven at $12 billion doesn't happen, because biotech eats up so much money. There's so much dilution that you end up with a good pile of money, but it's nothing like what people think it is, basically.
So when you think about the fascination and the acceleration of investment dollars coming to the space, what's a piece of advice you have for, let's say there's a sophisticated individual, maybe they built and sold a company and their family office is looking, doing some investing, and they're fascinated with the space. What's any advice you have for not getting taken by the snake oil salesman, as we call
it? It's a very, very good question. It's the most important question there. And because, you know, the elixir of youth has been peddled for 5,000 plus years, and it's only now that our biological intervention to change or to alter the pathways of aging is possible. And it's at the very early stage. We're in the kind of the internet in 1995 type stage. I can see in 10 years' time, as Brian Johnson, who's, you know, the famous guy who really does live the sort of ascetic life in order to live a very long time, says, don't die, because in 10 years' time, there will be something out there that will really be of assistance to all of us. But the roadblocks in this area, first of all, exactly what you just said, Jess, which is that there are plenty of snake oil salesmen out there. There's so many charlatans, so many anti-aging companies that are doing anything but anti-aging. The second is that all good drugs and therapies should go through the FDA licensing procedure. That takes a lot of money and a lot of time and is uncertain as to whether it's going to succeed. And then the third and key thing is that we all live, hopefully, a long life. So there's no pill that I can give you today in a trial and say, well, okay, we'll wait for 40 years and see if it's enabled you to live beyond, or 50 years beyond your what you would expect to live. Because no company can sustain that sort of longevity in terms of its expenditure. So we need to find near-term commercial applications that, measured with biomarkers and with other diagnostics, might be able to show some anti-aging effect, but has a patient population which is very specific where money can be made. Otherwise, the companies can't be successful. So what I would say is that, first of all, go to companies that have proper FDA trials, decent managements with decent track records, and not spending money on, you know, ridiculous things like doing conferences in Costa Rica to talk about stem cells or extending telomeres or anything like that. Everything is actually approved and going through the due process of the American licensing system, which is by far the best and the gold-plated one in the world. What else can I say? Try and find a company that's got a commercial application that's beyond anti-aging, that looks like it might have a chance of success, that there's not a lot of alternative competition. They have something novel. They have robust IP with long duration, and that they have reasonable finances. And then, you know, put your money into that. But don't put too much money into that, because this is one of those moonshot investments. It's what I would call a money fountain if it works out. But if you put $1 million in, you might get $1 billion back. I mean, fancifully, maybe $100 million back. But you don't need to put $10 million in. This is what I'm saying. The scale relative to your wealth should be relatively modest.
Yeah. You know, so I met Brian Johnson on Tuesday, and he agreed
Great
to come
guy.
On the podcast. Greg and I are going to co-host an episode, and he's an intense guy. And I don't know that I don't know where I sit on all the things he's doing, but it's fascinating that he's pushing so hard.
Yeah. Well, I interviewed him. We have a charitable thing called the Longevity Forum. And Andrew Scott, who wrote The 100-Year Life, Dafina Gracchi, who's my other half, and myself co-founded this thing. And every year in London, again, please come to it. We all convene, and for a whole week, there are events around longevity. And I interviewed Brian for that. And in fact, I'll send you the YouTube so you can sort of, you know, see,
yeah,
you know, to see what he's like. He is... I at the beginning I thought, okay, this guy's kind of like wacky because, you know, he's transfusing his son's blood into himself and his own blood into his father, and, you know, he doesn't do anything that you and I might consider to be fun. To talk about going to bed, you know, it's like he goes at a very specific time. There's no phone in his room, there's no TV in his room, there's nothing. I mean, basically everything is an e-seat lifestyle, but he is doing it on behalf of us all, because he is the guinea pig that we're not prepared to be, to show us, you know, what works and what doesn't work. And I think it's absolutely fantastic. And I asked him the question, as I'm sure you will as well, is he doing this for money? I mean, he's got some products like an olive oil product and so forth. And I genuinely don't think he is. I think he is a natural entrepreneur. He's a very good entrepreneur, but he's not doing this for money or attention. I think you'll have if it's you and Greg together, I think it'll be a blast. I can't wait to see it, basically. But I'll send you the YouTube later on.
Oh, please. And when's I totally want to come to that. When's the conference?
It's in November. Jess, you're on the list now. So I'll make sure that Laura sends you all the details on that.
Oh, thank you. I'd love to come. Speaking of another thing I want to come to, let's take a total tangent and then we'll come back to this. Talk about the TT on the Isle of Man.
Okay, all right. So this is totally anti-longevity, because on average, 7 people die a year at the TT race. It is the biggest motorbike race in the world. 50,000. I live in the Isle of Man, just to put it in perspective. The Isle of Man is a sort of rock in the Irish Sea. It's about 220 square miles. It's very pretty, very beautiful. And since 1905, there's been this race. And the reason there's this race in the Isle of Man is because there's speed limits in the UK. And on some roads in the Isle of Man, there are no speed limits. And so these daredevil motorbikers go around, and it's an organized race, and there's a kind of free-for-all race. So we get 50,000 motorcycles coming over in June to race in this race. And it is so scary. I mean, I know you were saying that you went to Formula One with Greg, Formula One is sort of antiseptic compared to this. This is unbelievable. And the worst ones are the tandem bikes, you know, the ones where they have sidecars, which they don't really have. They're not sidecars. There's someone standing on the back of a tiny little platform at the back of the motorbike, and they... Honestly, you have to see it to believe it. So come and you'll have a great time. It's fairly, it's not like a glitzy sort of thing, you know. There's not a lot of Hollywood glamour there, but it is a remarkable event. It's really, really, really worth visiting.
So, and I'm totally getting back to those subjects, but how did you go from living on a rock near Ireland to also spending time in Ibiza?
Oh, well, I pre about the same time, I bought a house in Ibiza and I bought a place in the Isle of Man. And Ibiza, I actually don't know why I bought in Ibiza, because I'm not really, I don't like going to nightclubs or going out late at night. And we, Dafina and I, who works for Blackstone, by the way, which is a remarkable lesson in how to run a successful business. We like to go to bed quite early and I get up at 4:30 or 5 o'clock every day. And Ibiza just seems completely antithetical. But you know, you get a place, and I'm sure you, it's the same with you, Jess, and you know, oh, I can't be bothered to move, or you know, I've got my friends around, or what. And in our case, we have seven dogs in Ibiza, and it's just tough to move. But you know, I do think, I know Greg spends a lot of time in Ibiza, by the way, that we're going to be fried to death because climate change is really affecting Spain and the Mediterranean at the moment. I mean, we've not had any rain for 9 months in Ibiza, none. And we drilled three wells in the last year to try and get some water on our property. Couldn't get any, and so I have to buy water. And you know, okay, in the context of someone who's relatively wealthy, it may not sound a lot, but it's €1,000, which is about $1,000 a week to pay for the water. Now, you're sitting in Utah, you wouldn't pay $50,000 a year for your water, but that's what we're paying, basically.
Wow. Well, I'll probably see you there because Greg invited us to come stay for a week. So hopefully we'll be there at the same time as you.
He has a different life. You come and visit us, okay? I mean, I'm not saying to stay. You're going to stay with Greg, but come and visit the house, because we have Spitfire in the garden. We have a tram from the Isle of Man in the garden. And we have seven dogs, so you and you know, whoever you're coming with, you'll have a great time visiting us. And by the way, we don't have a curfew like Greg does, so you won't have to go home at 5:30 for extra sleep.
Although
So,
maybe I need some sleep training. I'm trying to be more like Greg if I ever grow up, right? Okay. So, let's go back. When you think about, I want to talk a little bit about this investing in longevity or anti-aging kind of world. One of the things I loved all your advice, and one of the things I want to go a little deeper in is this idea of understanding the quality of the management team, because it's so easy for the rest of us civilians to hear like, oh, they got a PhD from this fancy sounding school, and they were part of this fancy company that made a lot of money. But it might be harder for the rest of us to understand like, what did they really do at that company? And you know, like, sure, it all looks good on paper, but like, how do we get enough, you know, like, how do we talk to enough folks around them to really understand, like, was this really the person, you know, largely responsible for that success, or were they just a passenger on the caboose, you know? And so, as you think about vetting people whose resume looks absolutely great, who I'm sure you've been disappointed in some of those people in the past, as you think about like the people that interview well versus the people that perform well, or the people who look good versus the people that are good. Do you have any thoughts on discerning that?
Yeah, I think that this is not a skill that I have, right? So I'm not good at interviewing people. I just take a chance on people. And the people I work with, I'm talking about in my own family office or in the businesses which I have a greater degree of control over, we've been working together for a very long time, 30, 20 to 30 years on average, I would say. So, you know, there's no perfection. But I think loyalty counts for a lot, and but I'm just not very good at that triage, which is a very necessary one. But people who, as you rightly point out, Jess, who are great on paper and really impressive when you talk to them, for the time that you interview them, but I just don't have the patience to go through the monumental amounts of interviewing that someone like Goldman Sachs or Blackstone does. But there is a trick to it, and I just want to refer back to what. Where Dafina works, if I may, for a second, Blackstone. I was thinking about this before I talked to you today, and I really wanted to get this message across. Blackstone is $150 billion US dollar market capitalization company, and it's the world's largest private equity and property owning company in the world. And it has 4,000 employees. Okay. Goldman Sachs, which is a pretty good company, has 20 times the number of employees and has a lower market capitalization than Blackstone. Citibank, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, HSBC, our biggest bank here in the UK, which is called Lloyds, which is a terribly managed institution but has a very big market share. All of them have tiny market capitalizations compared to Blackstone. There's something about the model where you really get the right people to work for you, something I'm not very good at, but your question is so apposite. You really take the time to make sure you curate the right people. And then you build an asset-light business that is just so focused, so relentless, so on message, so keen on the numbers. I mean, keen on the numbers in terms of just getting them absolutely right, that you end up with a company with $150 billion market capitalization and $1 trillion under management. And so Blackstone, to me, and I watched Dafina with awe. I mean, I don't know anything about the detail of the company, but I do know that this is a brilliant organization. And there are some things that I'm trying to learn for myself that Blackstone practices that other companies just don't have. And one of them is that they hire very, very, very carefully along the lines of what you were just talking about so presciently. I think that, you know, you're absolutely right. And so I think neither Greg or I, to be quite honest, have the patience to sit through 17 rounds of interviews with people. So we make judgments, and sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. And so, as I said, there's good and there's bad in the stuff that we do. And it's all down to the people.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll go a different direction. There's so many people in business investing that would like to accomplish what you have. And yet, statistically, so very few have. What do you think is different about you? Or what's maybe one of the core principles that you feel like has served you so well over your career?
Well, first of all, I feel inadequate in the context of some of the people that I see, you know, around me. Who've done so much better than I have, and but they have something which I don't have, which is some sort of extraordinary ability to drive forward a new invention, or they can see a new market that I can't see. So what I am is a very competent plagiarist and a very good jumper on bandwagons, and I'm very fast on the bandwagon, by the way, and then a mobilizer like Greg. Together we're brilliant, of capital that surrounds those bandwagons that we're pushing forward, because we don't have enough money to advance all these very expensive projects ourselves. So we need other people's money, but we are also integrate. So we want those people to make money. And that's why we invest at every stage with all the other investors on identical terms, so that we're not sort of promoters who buy at 1 cent, sell at $10 or $100 or whatever. We are genuine investors for the long term. And we go up and down with the investors that we bring in. So we regard everything as a partnership, really. But I think both Greg and myself understand and can seize an opportunity. We also work very hard. You know, there is no easy way to make money. There's no sort of casino that you just go in and suddenly the money comes pouring out. As I said to you, I get up at 4:30 or 5 o'clock every morning. I work until sometime after lunch normally, which is quite a few hours, and then typically I do some work in the afternoon. But you know, you've got to work and you've got to read a lot. I mean, reading is really key to getting you know, to know something. Like, I mean, most people, you say what's fusion, they wouldn't know the difference between fusion and fission. I mean, that's honestly, almost no one knows that difference. And the only way you're going to get that knowledge is by reading. The only way, for instance, that I was lucky enough to know people and to understand the whole rationale for this, because I was the co-founder of a uranium company in 2006, which we sold. But I knew that last year uranium was absolutely the right thing to invest in. So we put a lot of money into uranium and made very, very good money. So it's just about accumulated knowledge, knowing a lot of people, making everyone your partner, being decent to people, and then you'll do very, very well. But doing the like if, if I had a son, which I don't, but if I had a son, he came to me and said, "Oh, Dad, I've got a great idea. I want to start a chain of coffee shops." I'd say, "Well, what's different about your coffee shop to anyone else's coffee shop? You've got to have a distinguishing proposition. You can't just have, I'm not going to start a dry cleaning chain because there's no barrier to entry. Find something that has a moat around it that you genuinely can protect."
It is one of the interesting things that's fascinating about the drug development that you've done and the ability to have those rights for 20 years and these kind of things, right? One of the things that I actually admire about both you and Greg is like when we talk about investing in these businesses, which have obviously, even with the losses, have net done so well for both of you. Greg says things like, "Well, if this isn't a space that's like in your circle of competence, just don't put all your money in it. Put 1% of your money in it. Try it out." Or like, just now when you're saying you were before you were saying like, no, don't put all your money in it. Just try a little." And
Absolutely.
so many of the promoters are like, "I would get as much of this as you possibly can." Like I just hear the reverse message, and I think that says something about your integrity.
Well, we really, Greg and I don't want, both of us come from, not humble, but, not very wealthy backgrounds. And we don't, we saw our parents and, they had some savings, but not a huge amount of savings. And I just don't want people to lose money because of, I can't sleep at night if I think, I mean, we're all going to lose money in something or other. You can't be right all the time, but don't try and mislead people. And I know people who mislead people. I do know promoters who literally steal money out of people's pockets. It's disgusting.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Let's switch gears. You are so passionate about the future of food. And I don't know, to me it's so interesting, growing up in a farming community from 100 years of farmers in the background, coming over from England to be farmers in Western Alberta in the 1890s and stuff, okay? And so my dad, even though he was a community development officer for the provincial government, he would come home and put his clothes on and then go out and garden. That's what he did for fun when he got home, right? And so I got to do more than my fair share of it, whether I wanted to or not, right? And but to me, like from an investor standpoint, like putting in a seed and getting back multiples is actually kind of interesting. But I want to know what you're excited about on the future of food.
Okay, so first thing I'm going to say is that what we're doing in food is multi-generational. It's going to take a very, very long time. And so we're not trying to get rid of conventional farming tomorrow morning. We're not trying to put people out of business tomorrow, but there is a growing demand, particularly for animal proteins around the world and from countries that were formerly poor that are now getting to be middle income, like China or India. There isn't enough land. There isn't enough environment to provide that protein for those people. And we know, at least I know, I think you probably agree with me, that we are in a climate emergency at the moment. And one of the main contributors to global emissions is conventional intensive farming, and particularly the dairy industry, and particularly the beef industry. Those are the ones that create the greatest amount of methane on the planet, and methane is 100 times more poisonous than carbon dioxide. So what we're trying to do is to find alternatives to some aspects of farming which can be made in laboratory conditions with much lower environmental impact, much less land use, much more food security, etc., etc. So I'll just give you a couple of examples. I mentioned dairy. There are about 250 million dairy cows around the world. I don't know if you were involved in dairy or not, but dairy is a very difficult business because the margins are very thin. There's a lot of contamination, a lot of issues with the cows, etc., etc. And as you probably know, a dairy cow will live for about 4 years, whereas if it was out in the field, it would live for 25 years because the it's got to be pregnant all the time, and its udders get so big that it breaks the back of the cow. It's a pretty awful situation, actually. And in some places, dairy production is completely inefficient. So in Saudi Arabia, for instance, where it's just hot, it's a desert, they import the cows, they put them into air-conditioned sheds, burning fossil fuels in order to provide the electricity to air-condition the cows, and they grow alfalfa to feed the cows using desalinated water. Again, highly energy-intensive. It's completely nuts, frankly. So what is being done now, and it's being done and on sale in the United States, is to produce the exact equivalents of the key components of cow's milk. This is not almond milk or soy milk or anything like this. This is what's bioidentical milk, using what's called precision fermentation. And this is very exciting because you can put plants in places where it doesn't make sense to have dairy production. You can reduce the methane emissions. You can reduce the environmental impact. And from my point of view, being very animal loving, reduce the cruelty to animals, although most consumers don't care about that. They really don't have a clue about the way in which animals are treated, out of sight, out of mind, as far as they're concerned. And we're building our first factory at the moment in the United States. It'll be up and running by the end of this year. The production has been pre-sold for at least 5 years. The returns are fantastic. We're investing about $150 million in it. The company was one that we started. It's called Liberation Labs, and it's owned by our investment vehicles that invest in this area. It's really exciting. Another area is eggs. You probably know that hens are kept in pretty appalling conditions. The average chicken lives for 26 days before it's slaughtered. But if you're an egg-laying chicken, you have a longer lifespan, but it's a pretty miserable life. But 60% of eggs are used in baking, confectionery, etc. And they're not shelled. No one sees the shell. You don't need the shell. So we can produce the exact equivalent of egg albumin. That will be on the market the dairy stuff is on the market already in the United States, but the albumin will be on the market within a couple of years. It's going to disrupt the whole of the egg producing industries. And then behind that, this is all called precision fermentation. It's like a brewing process, but behind that is the so-called cell agriculture, where you take a stem cell, very small sample from one living animal, doesn't get slaughtered. And from that, you can create any amount of food. But from an arable production point of view, from a fruit and vegetable point of view, from a sheep point of view, from the point of view of flowers or anything like that, it doesn't make sense to do this. This is only viable for dairy, egg, and for meat and fish production. And our first fish will be on the market in the United States by the end of this year or the beginning of next year, which will be tuna fish produced in a lab. So it's a disruptive force, but only in certain areas. It's multi-generational in its impact. It's going to take a long, long time for it to have an impact. So don't worry if you're an existing farmer, but it is there, and it is really exciting to me because it could make an immediate impact on the environment and particularly on the cruelty to animals. We didn't have intensive farming before the Second World War. Now, 99% of farming in the United States for the animals is intensive. And just to let you know, Jess, the average American eats 7,000 formerly live animals in his or her lifetime, right? 7,000. And the average American lives 6 years less than the average European, telling you something about how food and human health are connected.
Wow. I feel like we could do a whole episode on that. But I want to talk still about quantum infusion with our last couple of minutes. Why don't you give me a couple minutes on each? You're too interesting. We can't fit you all in an hour.
Oh, well, thank you, Jess. That's very kind of you. Quantum computing is it's going to displace a lot of conventional computing. It's always been an area of great promise, but now it's being translated into commercial success. And the company that I'm an investor in is now done a merger with, a merger with Honeywell's quantum division, which is a very leading. So the United States and the UK are the world leaders in this area, way ahead of China, which you'll be pleased to know about. And this company has just recently, in the last week, has raised $300 million at a $5 billion pre-money valuation. So it's real. There's real excitement among investors for this area. The first thing that will disrupt is the passwords on the internet. Cryptography will be completely changed. And the second thing is that Bitcoin will be completely changed by quantum, because the whole of the blockchain is based on conventional computing, not quantum. So you've got to watch this space. I would write a book about it if I had the capability or the patience to write a book about it, but I'm actually writing a book about fusion, which is the other place, the other thing you've asked me about. And again, the United States and the UK are the world leaders in this area. And from my old university, Oxford, is the kind of leader in this country around fusion. So basically, fusion is literally that. It's fusing atoms to create energy equivalent to the sun's energy, and without radioactive material, or very little radioactive material compared to conventional nuclear fission, without the need for uranium and all that sort of stuff. And the United States, Lawrence Livermore Labs, they've the first place in the world which has got more energy out than energy in. It's a kind of theoretical thing at the moment. But in the next 10 years, there's a possibility that you'll have on-grid production of fusion electricity. And if that happens, then countries which are formerly highly dependent on imports of fossil fuels may find that the geopolitics change for them completely. And so it's really important that the US and the UK collaborate on this, and that we don't allow bad actors to get hold of this technology through theft or through IP pillage, and that we make this our own project, because the UK and the US, or the US in particular, were the ones to develop the atomic bomb from which came nuclear, conventional nuclear energy. And this country, the UK, was the first one to have a conventional nuclear plant after the Second World War. But we, both the US and the UK, lost their advantage over time. We cannot afford to do that with the fusion. This is too important, too strategically important. So, you know, listeners, please talk to your congressman, congresswoman, and back the US-UK ventures in fusion. It's really important for us. Could be world transforming. Anyway, I'm writing a book on it. So there we are.
Ah, I love it. We could, again, do a whole nother interview on that one. I can tell there's enough there to talk about. Jim, this has been so fun for me. Thank you for making the time to do this.
I've really enjoyed it, Jess. I can't wait to see you in Ibiza. And as I said, come over. And I know Greg will be there, and you'll be staying with him. And you'll see the Spitfire, and we'll have a drink on my tram in the garden.
So great. Thanks, everyone, for listening.